It's 5 o'clock, live from Westminster, where David Cameron is staying on as Prime Minister. His party's won a majority of seats in the House of Commons. Anna Jones reports from Downing Street.
I've just been to see Her Majesty the Queen, and I will now form a majority Conservative government.
In his wildest dreams, David Cameron probably didn't really think he'd be saying that word majority outside Number 10 this afternoon.
I truly believe we're on the brink of something special in our country.
But as he was vowing to deliver on all of his promises, the fallout elsewhere was swift. Three leaders quit in 52 extraordinary minutes. Nigel Farage at 11:23.
I am standing down, as leader of UKIP.
Then Nick Clegg addressed weeping activists.
I announce that I will be resigning as leader of the Liberal Democrats.
And at 12:15...
Thank you for your kindness, friends.
Labour's Ed Miliband followed suit.
And now it's time for someone else to take forward the leadership of this party.
So three acting leaders will take their places when a very different looking parliament convenes.
Well, a night to savour for the SNP, who claimed 56 of the 59 seats in Scotland. Leader Nicola Sturgeon denies their victory effectively put the Tories in power.
It was Labour's job to beat the Conservatives in England, and, you know, Labour hasn't come close to doing that. Even if Labour had won all of the seats that they held in Scotland, they still wouldn't have beaten the Conservatives.
And it's just been announced that George Osborne will remain as Chancellor and Theresa May will stay as Home Secretary. One other story, the UK's pause to remember the end of World War II in Europe. 90-year-old Ken Hay served during the conflict and remembers how people treated him in 1945.
People were coming up and saying, "Give us a kiss, soldier," and that was rather nice. After the degradation we'd had with Jerry, it was rather fun to be treated as something for a while, you know.
There was a 2-minute silence on the 70th anniversary of VE Day at the Cenotaph in central London. There were other services across Europe. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me discuss the general election results is former leader of the Lib Dems on Bristol City Council, Steve Comer. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, today is the 70th anniversary of VE Day, Victory in Europe Day. The war with Japan in the Pacific carried on throughout May, June and July 1945 until US bombers dropped an atom bomb on Hiroshima in August and also Nagasaki. The Japanese surrender was announced on the 13th of August and signed on the 2nd of September 1945, 70 years ago. But tonight, what really happened to the keepers of the Nazi purse strings? We know Hitler had looted hundreds of millions in gold, securities, art treasures and other valuables. Did it all just disappear? Is it lying in a Swiss bank vault somewhere? Or was it secretly reinvested after the war? Also, we heard here that rather too many of the key personnel in ISIS have been supplied via the Penny Lane block at Guantanamo Bay by the Pentagon. Also, it seems Mohammed Anwazi, known as Jihadi John, had been turned from a peace-loving moderate Muslim into a crazed ISIS killer at the hands of our own MI6. So would it surprise you to learn the CIA and the Pentagon are funneling terror funding for ISIS through Swiss bank accounts? We hear this week from the US Army whistleblower Scott Bennett. And finally, the battle for your mind and the establishment's stranglehold on the power of the media. Hey, with Bullingdon Club member David Dimbleby and former chairman of the Young Conservatives Nick Robinson giving us their commentary from the BBC studio floor, and HSBC and BAE Systems directing the corporation from the chair and the vice chair at the BBC boardroom. Is there any hope of fair coverage of the affairs of the nation again? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius, some showers and breezy. Highs this weekend of 16, plenty of sunny spells with some showers though on Saturday. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius, feeling warm at the beginning of the week, getting cooler and wetter as the week progresses. Next week, that is. Next weekend, 16th and 17th of May, highs of 14, sunshine again and showers. Looks like April's finally here. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's Steve Comer, former leader of the Liberal Democrats on Bristol City Council. Hi, Stephen. And I suppose it's commiserations, really, isn't it? The Lib Dems didn't do too well last night.
I think it was described quite well by Nick Clegg in his parting speech as a catastrophic result. It did actually the worst result we've had in a general election since 1970, where we had 7.5% of the vote. It's now 7.8. And probably it's a worse result than that, because in 1970, the Liberal Party, as it was, only fought about 60% of the seats. So, yes, it is pretty bad. And I thought I could never get more depressed than I was after the 1992 election. And this one has topped that by some mileage, I have to say.
Some people might wonder, what's Tony invited Steve on today for? Because the reason is quite clearly because you predicted pretty much this a year ago when there were the local elections, which also gave a pretty bad result for the Lib Dems. So do you feel a bit pretty much vindicated by saying that at that point the Lib Dems should have changed their leadership, reshuffled and restructured?
I feel a bit like the child in the proverb who said that the emperor had no clothes. Because, yes, a year ago it wasn't just the local elections, which were another bad year of local elections. It was also the Euro elections. We lost all but one of the members of the European Parliament. Now, for a pro-European party, which the Liberal Democrats are, that's a disaster. And I felt then that if we didn't change the leadership and modify the message going into the general election, we would another tsunami would hit us the following year. And that's what's happened. And it's actually much worse than I think some of us, even the pessimists in the Liberal Democrats like me, it's much worse than we even thought possible.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, but the local picture for the Labour Party is not too bad, but nationally, let's focus on that first, a disaster really again. I mean, you could have expected to, surely, with a good campaign, to have trounced the Conservatives. There was a lot of problems with what's been going on over the last 5 years. It seems the message wasn't really hammered home.
No, it wasn't. And I think one of the problems with the Labour Party is there's a fatal ambiguity at the heart of it between more radical forces like myself and the mainstream who want to win through respectability. And it wouldn't matter too much if we could decide which it was we wanted to be, but we can't. And that's because of the electoral system that keeps us all in the one tent together squabbling.
You can't blame the electoral system, come on. Because no, you've done some figures yourself, right, haven't you? Come on.
No, this is,
let's have your figures.
This is interesting, because I thought, well, if we had a PR system election, it's the share of the vote that would determine the number of MPs. So this is not talking about who's going to get how many seats for a coalition. It's just looking at the general spread of political opinions. Now, if we call both Tories and UKIP the right wing of British politics, which I think is fair, then their combined total, so according to my calculation, I think Steve's checking it on the screen there, is 49.5%.
Yeah.
Now, the left wing of British politics is, we'll call them the Labour Party, the SNP, the Greens, and Plaid Cymru to begin with, because the Liberal Party, having been in coalition with the Tories, might be perceived to be not necessarily on the left. So all of the left parties together, without the Liberal Democrats, got 39.6%. So they're basically 10 points behind the Tories and the UKIP together. You can then add, with the Liberal Democrats in, because they are basically a left-of-centre party,
yeah,
an extra right. Let's just be absolutely clear here. This is on the actual number of votes cast,
yes,
not the seats. Percentage. Yeah, the percentage of votes,
votes
cast,
and percentage
right.
of the poll.
Yeah, so then they got seven. If you add the Liberal Democrats, 7.8% to the total, you then get the total left vote in across the UK to 47.4%. Now, if we include Northern Ireland in it, it doesn't change much, very much. But if you go up to 50.5% for all the parties,
so
on the
according
on the right,
to you,
and 48.3% for all the parties on the left. So in other words, there's a fairly evenly balanced spread between left and right wing views across the United Kingdom.
No, but according to this, you're saying that the Conservatives would have had an even bigger majority.
No, they wouldn't have had that. In actual fact, well, the point I was going to make is that the majority they've got was a majority of 8, is roughly in line with those kind of figures. So the first past the post system. But this is the point I'd like to make to Steve by comment, because even if we'd in the past, when Thatcher was in power, it was fairly clear if there had been proportional representation, she probably wouldn't have formed a government. But I don't think that's true of David Cameron's government that he's forming today.
Sadly not. And I think one of the things Martin pointed out about the Labour Party, I would also echo about the Liberal Democrats, actually, and that's this question of the ambiguity of whether you're a party that's a radical campaigning party of insurgents promoting an alternative view of politics, an alternative view of how to organise society, or whether you're insiders. Now, the problem, I think, and one of the reasons why UKIP and the Green Party have increased their votes, is that to a lot of ordinary folks out there on doorsteps, and when you telephone canvass them, they see Ed Miliband, David Cameron and Nick Clegg, and they rightly see 340-something men, all sons of privilege, all went to Oxford or Cambridge, and they say, well, you know, what is the difference? And all saying, there has to be austerity, there has to be cuts, and so on. So, I mean, I think when they look at that, they say, well, who is actually offering us an alternative? And I think that explains, on the right, the rise of UKIP, and on the left, the rise of the Green Party, because there are people who say, well, we need an alternative to that agenda. And I think the difficulty some of us have within the large parties is that too many people within those parties have bought into the establishment agenda, and there is no alternative.
Well, I broadly agree with that, but I think the problem is more, I think there are structural reasons. I mean, basically, the system is rigged to keep... It's a plebiscitary system that keeps the traditional ruling elite in power. It's not nobody else runs it like this in Northern Europe, and haven't done for decades. But there is also a fundamental problem because of the power of the media and formation of narratives. It's clear that there's a plurality. If you put, the UKIP voters feel disenfranchised, but what they lost on the swings, they gained on the roundabouts because the system, you know, their votes together. Of course, we might not include UKIP on the left. We've had some UKIPers on here who've got some fairly radical views about things like nationalising the railways and so on. So we can't be too black and white about it. But I think that Cameron can fairly argue that first past the post, by some fluke, has come up with what was a roughly proportional result. But of course, in Scotland, the SNP have benefited through first past the post. They have basically got, you know, less than half the votes and virtually all the seats.
And let's be clear as well. I mean, the Liberal Democrat vote between 92 and 97 didn't increase very much, but the number of seats more than doubled.
Yeah,
and I think
it's a lottery.
It has been a factor that one of the things about the Liberal Democrat growth at parliamentary level in the 90s and the early years of this century has been because we were doing first past the post better than we did in the 1980s.
Yeah.
But the trouble is that only lasts so long, and the system is broken. The difficulty is with a Conservative government, I don't see how you force a change because they're the beneficiaries.
Well, can I just bring up a very worrying point that, you know, that they wanted to redraw constituency boundaries, and that's where Liberal Democrats drew the line and said, you're not doing that. Good. I'm glad you did. But at the same time, they are now in a position with their American advisors, and I have American political advisors saying to them, right, as soon as you've got a victory like that, you gerrymander the constituencies.
Which is what the Republicans have done for years in America.
Steve, can I just ask you about Stephen Williams? Because he was quite a high-profile figure.
Yes.
Quite a nice, comfortable majority, reasonably comfortable. How come he lost out here?
I think it's this problem. The area of Bristol he represents has a quite a high percentage of... people who are quite alternative, sort of inverted commas, in their thinking, if I can put it
Isn't
that
it
way.
Isn't it quite a lot of PhDs, Martin?
It's the highest educated constituency in England, I think.
And lots of people who, bear in mind, it was a gain from Labour, off the back of the Iraq War, tuition fees the first time round, the feeling that the Labour government was too much orientated towards the political establishment and running scared of the Daily Mail agenda. I think Stephen benefited from that.
Yeah.
Once you get off it, once you got into office, he was always going to have a struggle to maintain it. What I think nobody saw was the rise of the Green Party in a lot of these areas, and I think that's what's really made it difficult, because Bristol West became a three-way marginal rather than a two-way marginal, and I think that made things much more unpredictable.
Just have a look at the figures, because Stephen's kicked down into third place. There's four main parties in Bristol West, starting with the lowest one is Claire Hiscott for the Conservatives, around about 10,000, well actually 9,750 votes. Then coming up from her, Stephen Williams is in third place with 12,000. Then the Green Party, Darren Hall, 17,000, and up to Thangam Debonair for the Labour Party with nearly 23,000. So she's now got a reasonably comfortable lead. But it's always a bit surprising to see someone go down two spaces rather than just one. You know, you've now got the Greens and and Labour to contend with. And you know, it almost sounds like that's, you know, this constituency is lost forever now.
Well, it's happened before, because I think I'm right in saying that when Valerie Davey won, and I think William Waldegrave went from first to third, because we forget that until 97 this was a Conservative seat.
Amazing,
for decades. Really? And I think what you've seen, a bit like with Brighton, is you've seen a lot of demographic change in West Bristol, and that a lot of the Conservative vote has quite literally died off, and things like subdivision of large properties into flats and multi-occupation has changed the demographic of that area. The population is now much more transient and a lot more volatile as a result. And I think that makes it the other factor, which is something about Liberal Democrats, is that one of the strong points we have is the local campaigning and the identification with local communities and community politics. That works where you have people who care about their area, where you have people who might be living in that part of town for 6 months and might move for another 6 months because of the problems of short-hold tenancy, then I think that becomes more difficult, because that community politics relies on people who relate to their local geographical community. And if people don't, because they've just moved in from London and might move out to Birmingham next year, then I think that's more difficult to establish.
Moving on to Bristol East, two main contenders there, it's fair to say. I think it's just Labour and Conservative, really, with the Conservatives, Theo Clarke, 14,000 votes, and Kerry McCarthy retaining her seat at 18,000, Martin.
Yeah, I think there's a fairly substantial UKIP vote in there, isn't there?
Yes.
7,000, yeah.
Yeah, so in other words, if the right had combined, they might have taken the seat. So, again, another thing. Can I just comment on Bristol West? I think there are communities that are transient, possibly more likely to vote Green rather than Labour, I would suggest to you. And there are other communities who are dug in here and are not going anywhere. I think what it is it's quite a progressive atmosphere around here. And Stephen, capitalised on that, as you said.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the Liberal Democrats voted against the war in Iraq. That means quite a lot to people around here.
Oh,
and they were prepared to give him a go on that basis. But, of course, it's the kiss of death. I mean, I don't think you should ever have gone into coalition with the Tories, from my point of view, or from your point of view. They could have had a minority administration and then just had to negotiate everything
I mean,
way.
I don't know, is it worth actually looking at?
In my view, that would have been a way
Gordon
the way
Brown
we could have done
actually
it.
Stepped down as Prime Minister, even though there was still a chance of making some sort of.
No, I don't think we could have made a alternative.
The problem with the numbers didn't stack. I think there were two problems. Firstly, Gordon Brown had clearly lost the election, lost a lot of votes from 2005. And secondly, the numbers for a coalition with Labour didn't amount to half the magic 3-2-3 or whatever. I think there were further issues, and that there was a view of a lot of people within Labour that they ought to go into opposition and regroup. Yeah. I know a lot of people, I was involved with the Liberal Democrat group on the Local Government Association, and that was quite a strong view of some key figures in their local government wing at that time. So I think there were difficulties. Where I would criticise what's happened with Liberal Democrats is that I think the coalition agreement was on the whole pretty sound and pretty solid. There was always going to be a problem over the tuition fee issues, and I won't rehash that one again. But the presentation of what was going on was difficulty, and a huge difficulty for us, and I don't think they managed the communication of what coalition government meant to a country that hadn't experienced it in recent decades. And that was a key difference. And then when you get hit with things like that aren't in the coalition agreement, like NHS reform, the bedroom tax and so on, then I think you ended up with a perfect storm.
Yeah, well, I thought you might have done it. Either, I wouldn't suggest forming an alternative government because the numbers didn't quite stack up. They would have stacked up under a PR system, but in the first past the post, they didn't quite stack up. And of course, in Europe, this would be normal. You know, the left and the right caucus at the end of an election and work out who's actually got the plurality. Now, it didn't quite stack up under first past the post, but on the other hand, you could have had a minority Tory administration. You could have let them in there, and they then have to, you know, if they can convince the Liberal Democrats that what they're doing is right, then you vote with them, and they can pass that legislation. And they would have hated that, and it would have actually corralled them. But okay, so you've then gone into coalition. I think that at some point you should have had it in your mind, if they were going to cross red lines, to just walk away and precipitate an election. In which case, you could have done rather well, because you would have been the people saying, "Look, we are people of principle. They've gone too far here. This NHS stuff, we're not having it. We're going to have a general election about it." And the Liberals would have been the leaders of that kind of move, if you see what I mean.
I think that's possible. I think one of the achievements of the coalition, funnily enough, is the Fixed Term Parliament Act, because I think that takes.
That doesn't seem much like an achievement to me.
Well, no, I think it is, because one of the dangers that caused the coalition to happen, well, I think there was a big worry that if there'd just been a confidence and supply arrangement, and a bit like 1974, which was the first election in which I voted, where the Prime Minister, you know, David Cameron, would have been able to go to the Queen 6 months later and said, I want another election. Now, at that time, you know, Martin, that the Labour Party was broke, the Liberal Democrats were broke. The only people who would have funded a general election campaign would have been the Conservatives, because they always find the money somewhere.
Well, if we're going to talk about the money, which the creation of this narrative about austerity, there's a very good article by Simon Wren-Lewis in the London Review of Books, who's an Oxford professor in economics. And he's saying, in the economics departments around the world, people like Cameron and Osborne are regarded as numbskulls. The whole idea that you've got to cut is absurd. In fact, in certain circumstances, in an economic depression, if you try to cut, you're going to make things worse rather than better. That's well understood in economics departments. But he says what we've got is what he calls media macro, which is focused around government expenditure and only government expenditure and borrowing. And this is the general, and it fits in with the general culture of capitalism. We all know that you can't spend what you haven't got, the usual stuff. And that's played really well for the Tories as a psychological warfare tactic. And we're all, you know, mentioned earlier, there hasn't been a properly argued, cogent argument against austerity.
That was really the Labour Party's. Just a minute, that was your job, wasn't it? Job.
I have been trying to get them to take that on board for years and years, but of course, at a certain point, people don't want. I mean, the reality is, coming to the economy now, is it started to turn down.
Yeah. Martin, just one second, I've got to make this point, it's a silly little point, but I think, why on earth did not the Labour Party make so much of the fact that when they left office in 2010, the economy was just starting a tiny amount to pick up? And yet, when the Conservatives were so-called leaving office, actually they haven't left, but in April, the figures just before, literally the week before the election came through, and the economy was taking a dip. No capital, it seems, from political capitals made out of that at all.
Well, they tried their best.
They didn't.
I think one of the problems is this. People think that when you've got a problem, like an economic problem, if you have a hair shirt on for a bit of a while, and then you do some, you know, you beat yourself a bit, and then eventually you get better. And it's actually it's a psychological thing. People think that's what you do. And of course, what the Tories have done, and the government in general, have done, they did the years of pain where we lost our credit rating, the economy was tanking, and then, of course, they took their foot off the brake. So the deficit is, in fact, not brought down in one parliament, as it was never going to be. Ed Balls lost his seat yesterday. But he said, quite rightly, we can't bring it down in one parliament. That's undoable. And it is undoable. And we're going to have another parliament to bring it down.
And we've got the problem now where you've got because of the political debate was so narrowed, and you mentioned that the BBC earlier, you know, we kept having a debate about what might happen on May the 8th and permutations and so on. We never had a debate about the economics of the Tories were able to get away with the fact that there's uncosted cuts in their manifesto. And I said to people I've been talking to over the last couple of days that, you know, I bet some of the people who voted Conservative yesterday, the minute their hospital down the road is threatened with closure, they'll be outside picketing with placards saying, save our local hospital. They were never challenged on where these cuts were going to come from. And the other issue that I think has never been debated is the whole question of Trident. Because we've had Labour and Tories saying, well, we want Trident because it's a deterrent and because we do. It's billions and billions of pounds. And frankly, I've not heard a case why Trident is necessary from any party. And we've had Labour and Tory both saying they want to keep it. And we've had the leadership of the Liberal Democrats saying they sort of want to keep it, but go for a slightly cheaper option, a bit like buying a sort of second-hand car rather than a new one. And I think, well, in none of this is there a fundamental debate about where our security threats are. Because Trident is no damn use against ISIS. It's no use against the 7/7 bombers.
No, that's true. But of course, in Scotland, this told. Sturgeon just said, "Well, we don't want it. What's a waste of money?" But of course, when the other thing that was missing was the international context. We are drifting into possibly a shooting war with Russia and a potential of invasion of Syria. We didn't invade Syria because Miliband did, in fact, so if he's done nothing else for this country, he put a line in the sand and said, we are not going to go to war with Syria over this chemical weapons attack, which it has subsequently turned out to be, was not carried out by the regime at all, as Farage did, in, to his credit, point out. And when we talk about UKIP being on the right, they've also said some quite strong things about things like Libya and Syria.
They seem to be very against
the mainstream liberal interventionist centre that seems to have lost the plot on. And I think the real problem is that we're drifting into a, you know, mega crisis. And what the Tories represent is comfort and home and the idea that we'll be all right if we just clean
hang on to nerves for fear of something
that's
worse.
And of course, at the moment, with the economy kind of picking up, people could hope that it's going to be all right. It's not unnatural. People are naturally conservative with a small c. You know, in times of trouble, they often go for simplistic nostrums. Mm. I mean, and explain to them the complexity of a banking system that's completely shot to pieces, and the machinations of people like the CIA in Syria is way beyond people's pay grade. They don't want to think about it.
Well, look, you talking about pay grades, I brought this up last night as part of our BCFM election coverage, and you do wonder, don't you? I mean, doing this show, you get a bit cynical after a while. If, Steve, the politicians we're electing really are that high up the food chain, that the bank, the military industrial complex, the intelligence services, people like this are virtually untouchable. And actually, can the politicians really restructure things at the highest level? I mean, that's what we like to think when we cast our vote, but can they?
I'm not sure they can, because I think there is this problem with global money power. And I think one of the myths that the right like to propagate, whether that's the Conservative Party or UKIP indeed, is that the nation state can manage everything and can do everything. And increasingly, I think we've seen that that isn't the case. I mean, if you take the issue of tax avoidance, for instance, you know, half the tax havens in the world, half of them are British. They're British. If we really wanted to solve
money there, eh?
Yeah, if we really wanted to solve the problem of people evading taxes, then, you know, we could shut down the Cayman Islands and the Channel Islands and or, you know, the Turks and Caicos and all these places tomorrow, because they're British dependent territories. So, but instead we point the finger at Switzerland and Liechtenstein and Luxembourg. So I think this is a factor. I also worry about the whole issue of sort of military industrial complex, as it used to be called in America in the 60s, and just how that is going with the whole arms industry and so on. And yes, I do wonder about. I think there are limitations to power, and I don't see how you open it up, but I mean, it seems like people are trying not to have the question.
For example, we had a tour last year, didn't we, of in fact maybe it was even the year before, sorry, can't remember, but David Cameron did a tour of the Middle East, you know, selling British arms,
which are now being used to bomb civilians in Yemen.
I mean, Yemen is an awful situation which has begun about 3 weeks, a month ago, and it's just been carrying on ever since. Apparently a ceasefire possibly starting at the moment, roughly. But I mean, you know, there was no chance for this to be discussed and debated in the British Parliament because of the timing of it. And also, we've got now got British troops alongside Canadian and American troops in Ukraine training the Ukrainian army. That hasn't either been discussed in the British Parliament.
Not just the army, they're training these paramilitary battalions that have been involved.
So what
in
is happening over there, Marty? How can our army be going over to a non-NATO country, training people up, without any kind of discussion about
it?
I think the
real problem, Cameron is very much in the circuit of the power elite. They will be very pleased with this result.
Well, he went to the Bilderberg Conference,
well, he does,
didn't he?
When
they were in Britain in
2013. He definitely wanted to line up with the US neoconservatives to go to war with Syria over this bogus chemical weapons attack. He was stopped by the British Parliament, and Tories as well voted against it. And UKIP also voted against
it. It's interesting that I'm not sure, Martin might know better than I do, that the impression I got was that actually when they had a little meeting in number 10, that probably the three leaders were all convinced that intervention on Syria was what needed to happen. And I think it was backbench voices that probably stopped it in all three parties.
But Miliband could easily have not listened to that. But I can't remember who voted against. It was the usual. I think Liberal Democrats voted for it, didn't they?
I think there was a split. There were people against.
Yeah, because the people. I mean, there were 20 Tories against.
Yes.
And UKIP were against. And I think Nigel Farage is, he's now out of mainstream politics as he resigned today. When he said, "Look, this chemical weapons attack has been carried out by the rebels we're supporting," And this is just, and he also said, you know, Miliband was attacked for saying that the Libyan mess is partly responsible for the refugee crisis.
Oh, yeah.
Farage is stronger than that and said, no, Cameron's egotism in getting involved in destroying the regime in Libya
but ever
has
since,
caused the problem.
Ever since the post-World War One carve-up of the Ottoman Empire, we've had a problem where the West, Britain and America predominantly, you know, have had a hand-in-glove relationship with the House of Saud, and despite, you know, supposedly wars in Iraq being about democracy, you know, we've bankrolled and supported and armed what is effectively a feudal monarchy where there's no civil liberties at all, you know, in return for the oil it produces. And I'm not sure with the how much of the oil price reduction is due to the fact there's been some deal to get the Saudis to turn the tap on. I mean, that's what's happened before.
They've turned the tap on to try and get the Russians,
because
we're now in a geopolitical contest. Now, none of this appeared in the election campaign except in very vague code about Trident. If you see what I mean, that's we've unpacked all of that from the Trident, you know.
Even if you see Russia as a threat, then I don't see Russia as an invasion threat to the UK. It is a threat to its neighbours, and that's partly because in the breakup of the Soviet Union, you left behind a Russian speaking population in the Baltic states and Ukraine and so on, and the mentality.
In the Ukraine.
Sorry,
there would always be.
There would always been there.
Surely Russia is seen more as a geostrategic threat when it comes to countries like neutral, what used to be neutral countries like Ukraine, etc. There's a tug of war going on between the Russians and the EU and the US.
I mean, I don't see. See, one of the problems is, you know, people are saying that the Russian activity is in Ukraine and so on is a threat to security, and yes, the annexation of Crimea and so on. But I think it's more complicated than that, because, you know, if you were sat in Russia's position, and Turkey is similar in some ways, and you know they're a power that sees themselves under threat of encirclement, then actually the accession of countries in Eastern European in Eastern Europe into the EU was probably not perceived as a problem. But once they joined NATO as well, then that has to have been seen in Moscow as a hostile act. And yet, you know, we seem oblivious to the fact that that is seen as a hostile act.
That's across the mainstream. Miliband seems to not get the plot about this at all. I'll tell you one person who did seem to understand how silly all this was Michael Heseltine. And I hope that the Tories of his ilk are in the current crop.
But there are not many left, are there? There's not many left.
A bit of sense of, I mean, the American far right are hell bent on war with Syria and Ukraine, and the Israelis want to add Iran to the list. And they are going to win elections, these people, on that platform. And the question for a British government is, how far are we going to go down the road with this? I read a very interesting thing the other day.
And not just for the British government, but for EU governments.
I read a very interesting thing the other day, and I couldn't source it, that the Joint Intelligence Committee of Britain had carried out a war game in which America went rogue and started attacking countries without consulting with others, and what would Britain's role be?
The Joint Intelligence Committee is not a democratic thing, is it?
No,
it's actually the heads
is,
of the intelligence services.
No, but the point is that the war game had been, let's presume that the Americans have got some government that is determined to go to war with whatever. And of course, John McCain intends to be that president. I don't suppose he will be. I hope not, but he could well.
Okay, let's. I mean, we've been sort of dotting around some of the Bristol constituencies. Bristol North West is held by Charlotte Leslie for the Conservatives. The only one chasing really is Darren Jones for Labour. Was that bound to happen, Martin?
I think on this kind of night, Charlotte Leslie was going to retain her seat.
Steve?
Yes, I think so. I think there's a couple of factors at play here. Firstly, 5 years ago, Liberal Democrats made a play for that seat and actually got second place. And that clearly wasn't going to happen this time with a more defensive campaign. Secondly, I think Charlotte Leslie is a very good self-publicist. I mean, you know, you've got to credit that. And I think some MPs, maybe Chris Skidmore and Kingswood similarly, who get a sort of first-term incumbency bounce. I think it happened to a lot of the Blair intake of 97 and 2001. I think probably Stephen Williams benefited from that between 2005 and 10. And I think what we're now seeing, and one of the reasons on a local level why I think Labour and Liberal Democrats couldn't make any headway against Conservative MPs, was that, you know, they'd done their constituency work assiduously since the last campaign. And I mean, Warwickshire North, which, you know, should have been a banker for Labour, I think was majority of less than 100, they held on to. And I think there is this factor as well, as well as the global issue. I think there's also very local factors, and people like Charlotte Leslie and Chris Skidmore have been very good at playing the right local issues for the last 5 years.
Can I also say about Bristol West Labour Party as a member is we've worked very hard for that result. Very hard. And we put an awful lot of work in. You know, there's been an awful lot. I mean, you know, that's one, from my point of view, Tony, one of the few things that makes me reasonably not upbeat, but, you know, we did our job well here from our point of view. But the Greens, a Green Liberal Labour split is pretty much the spread of views around here.
I think part counter to that is that if you look at the seats on Labour's battleground list last night, yeah. Labour picked up the Liberal Democrat targets.
Yes.
You know, Hornsey and Wood Green in London, you know, the Bradford seat, the Norwich seat. They picked up those targets but didn't make headway against the Tories. And I think in some ways it was probably more the decline of the Liberal Democrat vote than a successful campaign by Labour.
What's depressing is that the, you know, people like Steve Webb have lost his seat.
Yes.
And it's basically, that's, I mean, what if you're an anti-Tory voter, why did I think the general collapse, I mean, to my mind, people should vote against what they don't want and not say, well, the Liberals have let us down here. That's not the point, is it? Not in that situation. You should vote to, it's, you know,
aren't you trying to second guess voters here a little bit? Because it might just simply be that he wasn't a very good constituency MP.
No, he was. He was a very good constituency MP. And, you know, as a Labour voting person, I voted for him twice as a tactical vote, because that's what you do. But I think...
But the reason you have tactical votes is that we don't have a proportional system.
Exactly.
But even, as Martin's pointed out, it wouldn't have made much difference anyway.
Back to my main point, even under a proportional system, I would suggest, I mean, the UKIP will feel hard done by today, but on the other hand, they've got their EU referendum, and the Tories are marginally, you know, the right in general are marginally ahead in the popular vote. And a majority of eight probably reflects just roughly
the kind of
support they've got.
So what we've got, essentially...
But of course, they won't necessarily...
Under a PR system, you'd have had a Conservative UKIP coalition almost certainly.
Yeah. What we've got, it looks like, is a kind of big red blob of Labour in the middle of Bristol now, surrounded by a sea of blue. And places like Gloucestershire, every single constituency now is a Conservative. But I'd like to have a look now at some of the figures that have disappeared, where you, the voters, me, the voters, us, the voters, have said, no, we don't want this person in politics anymore, for whatever reason. And some of them quite high profile too, aren't they? For example, in fact, some are reasonably obscure. I thought one of the most interesting was the Douglas Alexander being removed. The Labour's shadow foreign secretary, one of the top jobs in the Labour shadow cabinet. And also, significantly, Martin, he was Ed Miliband's chair of general election strategy. The voters have told him to...
It was Jim Murphy who was removed by a 20-year-old politics student, SNP politics student. Something
this
happened.
Is Renfrewshire, this is another Scottish
something
one.
Yeah. I mean, I used to work quite a lot in Scotland and Clyde Bank and doing stuff in Glasgow University when I was living in Poland. And the culture there was solidly Labour when I was up there, solidly. And those people have lost faith in the Labour Party from a more... fundamental perspective. And this is the problem for Miliband, is in order to keep Scotland, he's got to move to the left. For example, say we're not going to have Trident. In order to win in Gloucestershire, he's got to say,
well, would you, okay, let's just crystal ball stuff here, Martin. What would you have done in Scotland? Because it's a bit of a difficult
write
one,
it off.
Really? Just forget about Scotland completely.
Yeah, but then the implication of that, which I don't like, is that therefore the Labour Party should tack to the right to attract back these Tory voters that we've lost.
I don't think
that's right, because I don't believe the Tories, you know, those Tory voters are simply wrong.
Because we've now got this massive SNP bloc, a new quite interesting phenomenon.
I mean, I think the SNP gain were actually one of the highlights of yesterday for me, because I think they were articulating, you know, to me the SNP are a solid civic nationalist centre-left party. They were articulating a view on the deficit, which I think was very responsible. Actually, they were saying they were anti-austerity. When you look at what they were actually offering, they were offering spending increase of 0.5% of GDP, and there are people like Lord Greaves of the Liberal Democrats who will say that they actually called that right, that you know, they weren't saying saying, we can't have any cuts at all. They weren't making impossibilist demands, but they were saying, look, we need to take this a bit more slowly. It's hurting too many people, and we need investment. And I think it was a very sound argument. I think the problem for Labour in Scotland is it actually goes back probably 20 years or more. And I think the SNP have been able to capitalise on that. The other thing that occurs to me is that the referendum brought a lot of new enthusiasm behind the cause from across the political spectrum. And one of the things that was interesting, I heard several documentaries around the time of the referendum, and there was somebody who was a 60-year-old grandmother who'd got very enthused by the Yes campaign and got very involved with the politics of it. And instead of the reaction being defeat and dejection the day after, she more or less said, I can't do the accent, but she said, well, you know, I've enjoyed this. I'm not going back to my sofa and my daytime TV. Yeah. And I think if you look at the growth of their membership, then, you know, it's exponential. And people have been motivated by a cause. And I think that's to be welcomed, because there's too much cynicism in men in grey suits in politics. And I think to see that...
Well, Nicola Sturgeon's been definitely a breath of fresh air, has she not?
Yeah.
Under a PR system, all of this would have been dealt with a long time ago, as we know. But also under a PR system, as you pointed out, we could have ended up with a Conservative UKIP coalition. But then the SNP would still have been there. And this is the kind of thing that happened in Yugoslavia, the kind of thing that's possibly going to happen in Spain, the thing that happened in the Ukraine, is when once you get these really fundamental differences in choices of direction coming, then society fractures, and it's not always a peaceful process.
But we have an opportunity to have change without society fracturing. But to do that, you have to have a proper debate about federalism and subsidiarity. Because to me, if Scotland becomes independent but remains in the EU, or Catalonia leaves Spain, then actually, as long as you know where the competence of powers is between Europe, the nation state, local government, regions, or whatever, actually it shouldn't make a lot of difference. And, you know, there was a lot of rubbish talked about during the referendum campaign. I mean, you know, England and Scotland will still have close links and people related to each other in much the same way that England and Ireland do now after 70 years of Irish independence.
But how is this going to play out, do you think, over the next 5 years, having this big bloc? Is it 85, I think, SNP MP?
It's not 85. No, it's 55, isn't it?
56.
Well, I mean, the obvious first hurdle to be crossed is that this referendum on leaving the EU, which is probably going to take place now. Sturgeon has already said that, as far as she's concerned, this has to pass in each of the independent federal parts of the UK. So that, and it's not just that.
It's a bit of a spanner in the works.
Listen a minute. She's a lawyer, and the point she's making is not just that England can vote to leave, but we won't. She's saying I will veto England leaving unless we decide to join with them. We're in the union now. Now this is Cameron is going to have to deal with Sturgeon over this, because it is going to come to a head. Because and the question is, do people in Scotland want to stay in the EU? I think if Sturgeon, I think they're probably of that mind, I would imagine.
Yes. There's also a factor with this in that quite an interesting constitutional conundrum, because nobody's left the EU yet. But the Maastricht Treaty actually made us all citizens of Europe. I think there is actually a human rights issue. Bear in mind we have 2 million British people working in the other 27 member states, or living in the other 27 member states. That says, well, actually, just because the people back home, where I don't live anymore, have voted to leave, does that take away my rights as a European citizen?
It's all going to be wonderful.
It would be quite an interesting one for lawyers.
Because he doesn't really want to leave, does he? It's all these various spanners in the works are going to suit him down to the ground.
From a political point of view, if he could... He's hoping he's going to get some joy from Merkel and so on. I wish him luck with that. Alex St. Cyprius hasn't got too far. All of this stuff is ahead. I mean, the Tory party itself is actually internally divided. So when we see them as one homogenous block, I think there's big business is not really keen on leaving the EU. But a lot of their activists are.
I think Cameron's game was to repeat what Wilson did for the Labour Party in the mid-70s, in that, you know, you unify your divided party by going to Europe, getting another deal, getting a slightly different deal, and then selling it in a referendum. The difficulty then is that when Wilson did that, I think there was a European Union of 9 nations. It was relatively easy to do. You've now got 28. And the problem is, if I was Cyprus, or if I was Prime Viktor Orban in Hungary, I'd say, well, hang on a minute. If Britain's going to renegotiate the terms, I want to do it. And you end up with a domino effect.
Well, in other words, yes, if we can all start renegotiating the terms, but and this is in the middle of a massive crisis,
yeah,
which everybody's forgotten about. The banking system is still, it's not, it's, they see it as a crisis of the EU, but it's actually a crisis of the international banking system.
Well, one
system.
Of the things that and came out just away. Before the election, Martin, wasn't it, that Britain's economy is actually now looking worse than the Eurozone economy. That was in the figures in the week before the general election. But anyway, look, let's have a look, start to look at a little bit of the count that you've just been in next door at the City Academy, Steve, because some of the results are coming in from that. We've got actually what looks like quite a considerable number of gains for the Green Party. What I can see so far, Cabot Ward a gain for the Green Party here in Bristol, Cottam a gain for the Green Party, Easton a gain for the Green Party, Southville a gain for the Green Party. So we're going to see that I think the Greens is a you know, bigger and bigger increasing force on the City Council.
Yes, I think that's right. I think part of that is the fault of the leadership of the Liberal Democrats, because I think we've vacated a lot of that political territory on the centre left.
And what's just another one's just popped up, Windmill Hill too.
Windmill Hill, yes.
Gained by the Greens.
Not a huge surprise. They were quite close there last year. Southville, again, has had a Green councillor since 2006. The Labour held on to one of the two seats. So I'm not surprised with those, but Cabot is a big shock. Cabot was the first ward that the Liberals won as an independent party for several decades back in 1973, and have held it at city level ever since. So that is a major shock. Some of the of what's happened in West Bristol, and as I say, the pattern is not yet clear, is that there have been, because the two elections were the same day, I think there were people who voted Labour in the general election and Green in the local elections, and I think that's been a major disappointment for the Green Party, who were hoping they could take the parliamentary seat.
They've done very well. I think they came second in Bristol South as well, didn't they?
Yes.
So in other words, there is, I mean, what Bristol has got is a radical non-conformist culture, of which the Liberal Democrats, the Labour Party and the Greens are manifestations. And of course, under a PR system, all of this would be sorted out in a different kind of a way. I think quite a few people will have voted Green locally and Labour nationally. That's how it looks.
I suppose the other
and
question...
And also they took a lot of votes from you rather than from us.
Yeah, I mean, I think across the city they've taken votes from both, but I think because of the decline of the Liberal Democrat vote, I mean, if you look at somewhere like Bishopstone, for instance, I mean, I didn't door knock there, but I drove through it a lot. Loads of Green Party posters everywhere, and yet 5 years ago, Liberal Democrats won that by a considerable margin. We had 3,500 votes.
The Green Party are an insurgent, you know. They can't make much at local level. They can make advances, and they could, you know, they can make, you know, punch above their weight because they are insurgents.
So these wards, I don't know if you can help me, guys. Cabot, Cottam, Easton, Southville, Windmill Hill. They're gains from which party? Mostly Lib Dems, is it?
Easton would be a gain from Labour.
Yeah,
Windmill Hill was a gain from Lib Dem, but it was also, because of the way the cycle went, it was up last year and lost last year.
A Labour gain from Labour, surely. I mean, it's like they're winning votes from both you two parties. What are you going to do about it, Martin?
Well, what we've now got in Bristol West is Thangham is Debonair is going to be the MP, and she will have Greens and probably a more radical Liberal Democrat party breathing down her neck. She will have to tack to the left in terms of internal Labour politics. She's already pretty much suggested that that's the way she wants
to. Well, tell us a bit about Thangham and you.
I'll tell you the most interesting thing about her is that when she was elected as parliamentary candidate, she then put a round robin into all of the parliamentary candidates across the UK for the Labour Party and said, why don't we put together a letter to the leadership saying we want to renationalise the railways? Which she organised, and they did it. It didn't cause her to be extremely well liked in the central office.
And it didn't.
But I mean, I think that was a message that she wanted to send both to them and to the electorate.
Well, she's got a 5,000 or so majority there. Tell us a bit about her background, Martin. What kind of MP is she going to be, do you think?
Well, she's worked in a lot in domestic, around issues of domestic violence. That's a kind of professional life. But she was a cellist at one stage. A family originally on her mother's or father's side from Kerala in India. She's extremely, you know, I'm very pleased for her. We put a lot of work to get her elected, but I think she's not necessarily going to be a yes person in terms of the Labour leadership. She's already had a card marked on that one. She may not want to tack back from that, I don't know. But obviously, we put a lot of work into it, and we're reasonably happy.
Steve, some of the big figures are gone from the Lib Dems, aren't they? Danny Alexander, David Laws, also Vince Cable, Simon Hughes. This is almost like a decapitation.
Yes, it is, and some of those are, you know, from my political perspective, are more of a loss than others, I have to say. It's a terrible night, and when you go down from 57 seats, whatever it was, down to eight, then that's going to happen. And it almost, you see, one of the problems I think we've had with the denial from the leadership and the national campaign teams in the party was that they almost said, well, where we have MPs, we have incumbents, we can hold on even when the rest of the world is collapsing around our ears. Now, I always thought if we're in single figures percentage wise, if we're around the 10% level, then frankly that's a bit of an illusion, because if your vote's in meltdown, then however assiduous a constituency MP is, it's very difficult to swim against that tide. You know, we lost Martin Horwood in Cheltenham that we didn't expect. We lost Steve Webb in Thornbury in the 8 that I don't think any of us expected. There were some where we were fighting the Tories, like Somerton and Froome, Chippenham and so on, that, you know, were more expected to be losses because they were known as marginal seats, Wells and so on as well. But, you know, we've lost a lot of good people. We've got an interesting band of eight left. We've got a leadership election which I think needs to open a debate about where the Liberal Democrats are. Can we get back to being an insurgent radical party, and can we actually offer solutions that are alternatives rather than try and be the third establishment unionist party, which I think is what we've had in the Clegg years?
Well, one of the things I found quite surprising was the win from the Conservatives, despite the fact that in the part of the election campaign you had both Ken Clark and Norman Tebbit having a go at the leader, at David Cameron. Like, you know, this is not normal. This is the sort of stuff the former Home Secretary was doing in the run up to the last election, Martin. The lady with the red hair.
Oh yes, but Hazel Blears.
Was doing the same to Gordon Brown.
Yeah, well, I mean, Cameron.
But Cameron survived that, didn't he? Having Norman Tebbit shooting at him, as well as Ken Clark. You know, he's done quite well, really.
Keep your enemies close and your friends closer.
And also today, I noticed that the FTSE 100 is jumping at the general election results.
There's a surprise.
But I mean, the stock market, if we can come back to the minute, is incredibly overvalued. Incredibly overvalued. It's reaching all-time highs.
It's gone up 1.8%.
All-time highs
today
in Britain and around the world, because they're just juicing it with funny money. That's what's going on all around the world. Was that in the election campaign? It's all being juiced with funny money? It is. And at a certain point, it's going to
What do you
go.
Mean funny money, Martin? Well, Where's it coming from?
QE.
The QE and zero interest rates.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is not normal. So you're not supposed to do this, because it's like using up all, you know, you're using up all of your cards. You're supposed to actually, you know, we've got used to the
money doesn't really seem to be real
we've
anymore.
Got money, we've got
it's
used
just
to the
machine
idea.
Is printing
and
it. And
the traders in the stock market and so on have got used to the idea that whenever there's a hint of a crash, they're going to pump.
I mean,
print
Steve,
more money.
What are your thoughts about this? Because it does seem that money is just being used. There's somewhere as a machine printing it away. It's not actually coming into government immediately to spend or whatever. It's coming into the markets. It's coming into the stock market. It's being used, for example, by investors who are getting interest on stocks and shares to pump, to put into the buy-to-let market, this kind of thing. It's not actually finding its way into the real world much.
No, and it's interesting. I mean, I listen to Martin most weeks, and it's a bit like listening to the Book of Revelations at times.
Not a broken record.
Well, no,
then.
The impending economic doom.
But I mean, the point is, it only happens once. If you keep pressing the print money button, then you can put it off, but you just make the crash that much worse. So that little extra bounce in the stock market is going to make the final crash that much worse.
I think it's a short-term bounce, and apart from anything else, the stock market obviously likes stability, and with a majority government, then that, by definition, that stability. In fact, I'm surprised the short-term bounce isn't a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, there's various factors at work, but I think fundamental to all of this that we've all kind of forgot to talk about is the fact that the international banking system is way out of control, still is. Nothing. I mean, the real person who should have done something about this is Obama in the US, and he's bottled it. Basically.
I mean, there seems to be one thing missing from all the narrative I've heard in the run-up to the general election and part of the campaign, being pretty simple stuff. Well, interest rates are incredibly low. The government surely could be borrowing. Why can't they borrow?
Well, if there is a crash, Tony, that then these taboos may go out of the window. You know, you may find that government will find that it can do all sorts of things it thought it couldn't do because it's just got to.
I think it depends what you're borrowing for as well. I mean, if you're borrowing to build HS2, if you're borrowing to improve transport systems elsewhere, if you're borrowing for infrastructure, then yes, it's a good thing to do, and you've got the Keynesian philosophy that will generate jobs in the economy and money going round and the supply chain and so on. If you're borrowing because you've got to fund your welfare bill, then that's a recipe for disaster. I think one of the biggest mistakes that this country ever made, and if you look at Norway as an example, you know, they had an North Sea oil boom and set up an oil fund and did structural investment all over the country, particularly in remote areas. What did we do here? We gave it away in tax cuts for the rich and unemployment benefit for the poor.
That's absolutely right. And, of course, you can't go back and redo it.
No.
So we're going.
But
to
what about spending money in? I mean, there's one also another thing that doesn't seem to have come out much, and that is if you give money to poor people, they spend it. That's good for the economy.
Yeah,
if you give money to rich people, they hoard it.
In any case, all this stuff, the tax on welfare, and one of the saddest aspects of recent years, in my view.
Isn't it interesting? We've now using the term welfare rather than social security. I just mentioned that.
Of course, it's a psychological warfare technique to change the terms of the debate. What happened in Iceland when the banks collapsed? Is they massively increased unemployment benefit because everybody's unemployed, so they voted to increase unemployment benefit. That's what you do. But of course, what's happening now is that those who vote, there was a 60-something percent turnout, so 40% of people didn't vote. Those overwhelmingly, the 40% of people who didn't vote are the poor and the disenfranchised, the ill-educated, what have you. Now, you can make, there's all sorts of reasons why, but that's... I mean, we have basically got a property.
Isn't it something to do with apathy as well?
It is. It's a huge problem, I mean, especially for people working, you know, to try and change society. A lot of times, it's very difficult to motivate people.
I mean, do you find this on knocking on doors? Sometimes people say, "Oh, there's no point in voting, Steve."
I think that's right. And the point I made earlier about the, you know, the 340 somethings in suits, people say, "Well, they're all the same." And if you look at Clegg, Miliband and Cameron, then you think, well, actually, yeah, they've got a point, haven't they?
Well, Nicola Sturgeon obviously has been able to challenge that, as in Nigel Farage in his own inimitable style. But Nigel's a loser and Nicola's a winner. Hooray!
Are you surprised that they've actually lost a seat, Martin, that UKIP, rather
than
gained?
No, I'm not. I mean, I think that what Carswell said at his acceptance speech is, well, this is ridiculous. We've got, you know, millions of votes here. 12.6% of the electorate, and we've got one seat. So in there, you know, but of course, that's the way it works under a first past the post system.
I actually spent a couple of days in Ramsgate recently, and one of the things that's noticeable there is that although there was a UKIP campaign, there was no real splurge in terms of posters or anything for Farage, but equally there was an anti-UKIP campaign organised by, not by political parties, but by Hope Not Hate. And I think they are very much a Marmite party, and I think in a lot of these places, Rochester similarly, and you saw it in the by-election, where people were voting Conservative who weren't Conservatives, they were Labour or Lib Dems, but they didn't want UKIP.
Yeah.
And I think there's, you know, Thanet South was on Labour's radar with the split right vote.
Okay, we're getting towards the end of the show, or at least the end of the first hour, Steve. We've got big, big elections here in Bristol next May. We've obviously had a bit of a green landslide today for the local elections, and it's going to be an all-out election. That is to say, everybody, every single council is going to be up for re-election next May.
And new boundaries as well, don't forget that. There's that uncertainty as well. Going to be quite an interesting year.
But what about, will it actually make any difference? Because we've got a mayor now. What are the councillors there for?
Well, the mayoral election is at the same time.
Yeah.
So I think that was certainly a problem in last year's council elections, that, you know, the executive power is all with the mayor.
Okay, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to this week's guest, former leader of the Lib Dems of Bristol City Council, Steve Comer. After the news, we will have more fun and games with Martin Summers. And it's VE Day, what really happened at the end of World War II.
On your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.